Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 259, recorded for the week of May 8th, 2024. If only all my disasters could be managed. Good evening, Ryan, Jonathan, and Matt. How's it going?
Woo-hoo. We're all here. Great. Woo-hoo. How are you?
Hello.
Hey, it happens once a month where we're all here. It's good.
Yeah. And on the original recording day.
Yeah, harder. Even on the right recording day. So we're not all exhausted on Friday, which is the worst recording day. Well, we have a bunch of news to get to. So I guess we should just jump right into it. First up, Dropbox has revealed a major attack on its systems that saw customers' personal information accessed by unknown and unauthorized entities. The attack detailed in regulatory filing impacted Dropbox Sign, a service that supports e-signatures similar to DocuSign. The threat actor had accessed data related to all users of Dropbox Sign, such as emails and usernames, in addition to general account settings. For a smaller subset of users, the threat actor accessed phone numbers, hash passwords, and certain authentication information such as API keys, OAuth tokens, and multi-factor authentication tokens. And worse, if you've never had an account but received a signed document, they also had your email and name exposed as well. So double whammy all the way on the way. So wah, wah.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, especially if you weren't even a paid member of the service. But I almost feel like it now. My data's been stolen many times. No longer belongs to me.
Yeah, my email address is definitely on the dark web a few times. I get notified every once in a while.
Yeah, I get a bunch of, you know, my data's been breached, so I get, you know, dark web monitoring, a bunch of things. And, you know, most times it's like, we found your email address. Like, cool, where'd it come from? We don't know, but it's yours and it's new breach. And like, great, cool. So like, it's dark web monitoring is not really that helpful.
No, it's
that's
really
what I'm
not.
Finding.
I also like that it's my password is, you know, in my email, but it's there's no way that that password is current because it's been, you know, I've been breached a number of times and I go through and I rotate everything. And then now with Yahoo, you know, there's password lists. And so it's all multi-factor based. So. Like, I don't think you could have my password because I don't have it.
I mean, I've used one password for so many years that everything is random at this point.
I think it's nice when sites offer you the opportunity to not use your email address as a username. And in the last year or so, I started using unique usernames as well as unique passwords. I used to use like the beginning of my email address or something, but now I make a sort of semi-random username as well, so that I know that username doesn't get reused on other services. Thinking about how compromised email addresses is how things like 23andMe and other sort of credential stuffing attacks works, where people reuse things like that. So yeah, it's unfortunate that it was compromised. It was their acquisition, wasn't it? HelloSign that actually had the defect, not their main product at least.
Mm. I love that. This reminded me I should change my password for Dropbox. So I just did it as we were talking because that's the kind of multitasker I am. And then it goes, would you like to try the new Dropbox password sync feature to store this password into? No, I'm good.
Can you think? I've had Dropbox for so many years that like I'm sure this might be actually be a password that's like actually a password.
Yeah, it's funny. It you know remembers every device I've ever logged into. So like every web browser, you know, every computer, like my old PC from like 10 years ago, is still in here. I should delete these. I should unlink all these old accounts. I'm sure that's a hacker opportunity.
Yeah.
It's best. So I should do that at some point soon. Not doing a show though.
It's pretty interesting when you download your data that companies have on you. It's nice being in California where being able to do that is a legal obligation. I exported a bunch of my Google data not that long ago. Because I needed to find the exact date that I'd been to a store, which I drive past all the time in town. But I needed the date I went to the store to buy something so I could get a warranty exchange because I didn't have the receipt. And I exported my entire Google location history for the past 14 years. Wrote something in Python to go to all the JSON to find out exactly. It was really interesting, the data they have and the way they like assign sort of probabilities to the fact that you stopped at a particular place or whatever. It's really cool. But yeah, it's
I feel like you don't understand that not every take needs a hammer or a sledgehammer. Like, there probably was an easier way to get that information. Maybe a credit card bill?
I tried the credit card. It was more than 12 months ago, and so I don't have paper statements, so it wasn't available online anymore. That was the last chance I had. In the end, I couldn't find the exact date because, like I say, I drive past it all the time anyway, so it kept appearing in the search. And so I went in there, I'm like, I know it's between this date and this date. And the guy's like, okay, I'll just exchange the battery for you anyway. I'm like, thank you very much.
It's pretty good. I mean, I applaud your integrity. Most people would have been like, yeah, no, it was November 13th, whatever.
Yep. Napa Auto Parts, battery under warranty.
Well, last week, Matt brought up, there's rumors on the web about VMware and AWS parting ways and no longer offering VMware Cloud on AWS. And apparently that meant enough of a kerfuffle that the CEO of Broadcom, Hock Tan, issued a blog post titled Here Today and Here Tomorrow. So basically, he says that reports have been false and construing that the offering would be going away, forcing unnecessary concern for their loyal customers who have used their service for years. He goes on to then quote Winston Churchill, which is always hilarious to me, and then goes on to report the service is alive, available, and continues to support customer strategic business initiatives. What's really going on, he says, that VMware Cloud on AWS is no longer directly sold by AWS or its channel partners. It's that simple. It means that if you previously purchased a VMware Cloud on AWS from AWS, you'll now work with Broadcom or an authorized Broadcom reseller to renew their subscription and expand your environment. Customers can have active 1 or 3 year subscriptions with monthly payments that were purchased from AWS. And AWS purchase items will continue to be invoiced till the end of your current term before you're forced to pay Broadcom directly. So basically, what happened was AWS didn't like the new partner agreement terms and said, no, we're not going to sign those. And they said, fine, but then we're just not going to let you be a reseller. Mm-hmm. That's how I see this. And this is actually what happens on Google and Azure as well. Broadcom selling the service directly. You don't buy it through them, through the cloud provider itself.
I wonder if they lose out on opportunities for, you know, sort of better integrations by doing that, though. I can imagine VMware and AWS actually required more than just generally available APIs to make you do things. So I kind of wonder if they're going to lose out or customers are going to lose out and probably lose out in pricing as well.
Oh, I'm sure Broadcom wants to increase the price to you, the consumer, when you had to renew your Amazon contract. So, yeah. I mean, so basically what was happening on Friday was that people were getting wind that Amazon was going to be able to resell VMware and people were panicking about that. Right. So if you didn't get that deal done before this happened, sorry, you're now negotiating with Broadcom directly.
And that means that you probably can't use your EDP or anything else towards it, which it can be a big deal for companies.
Yes, it can be. Just one more reason you should get off the payday lender of technology that is VMware. All right, well, moving on to AI or how AI is ML making money. One of the biggest ML makers of money is Snowflake, of course. And so for those of you who use Snowflake, you know that your bill can get crazy out of control very, very quickly. And Jonathan and I recently did an interview with the FinOps Foundation guys. We were talking about focus. And we were saying Snowflake is a great opportunity for focus to be adopted. So hopefully tell your Snowflake rep that you want focus to be supported by Snowflake. But in the meantime, they did give you a nice new dashboard with a new cost management interface. This is dedicated. Snowflake is dedicated to providing customers with intuitive solutions that streamline their operations and drive success. And to help customers, they're introducing updates to the cost manage interface, making managing Snowflake easier at the org level and accessible to more roles. You can tap into cost data at multiple levels from the organization's view to individual teams. And the latest enhancement provides visibility into your spend at the organization and account level, ensuring you have the insights needed to make informed decisions and seek proactive measures. Organization overview gives you spend summary, contract overview, and account spend summary features, and new features to account overview include monitoring account spend, forecasting spend, identifying top areas of spend, and optimizing your spend. All about your spend.
Sounds expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say, while you're giving them all your money.
You guys are stunned. I see. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking through, like, I've never really run a workload on Snowflake, so I've always preferred to sort of use a native or closer provider or just something managing myself. But then I was also like, I don't know if I fully understand the capabilities of Snowflake, so I'm sticking through it.
I mean, you've ran Databricks in the past, though, so you know how much a cost hog that thing is.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Just, just imagine that, but instead of it being in your account being expensive, you're paying it in their account being expensive.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know people have used it and they've told me it, you know, this was several years ago. So probably about 5 years ago, it was exponentially better than any of the other data warehouses on the market at the time. You know, dramatically better than Redshift, you know, and was able to process data differently than BigQuery. So there was things that worked better on BigQuery, but there were more general workloads that worked better on Snowflake. I don't know if any of that's still true, but.
I've never used it either. Maybe soon I'll get to, but it's definitely one of those areas of you know, people I've known have used in the past that it gets very expensive very quickly if you don't keep an eye on it. So, you know, make sure you're controlling your spend.
Yeah, at least they have budgets though. They can enforce spending limits per account or group of people. So you can stop a rogue app from going off and spending millions of dollars over a weekend but doing things it shouldn't be doing.
I mean, it's great for your IT team who can, you know, tell the CFO, I saved you a bunch of money over this. It's not so great when you're selling it as a SaaS service to your customers and you can't really tell them no.
Yeah.
So that's a slightly different use case.
Yeah, I kind of wish they'd go down the other path and sort of give you provisioned infrastructure and you pay for that rather than pay for on-demand queries. And that way, you know, you can put up with slower performance with a fixed budget.
Moving on to AWS. So recently we talked about the DNS firewall, which allows you to basically prevent outbound connections to DNS servers that you, or DNS zones that you did not successfully authorize, which could be a problem if you're using any of the Amazon managed services that leverages CNAMEs or DNAMEs. And so basically this problem that they introduced, they're now fixing. So you can now configure the DNS firewall to automatically trust all domains in a resolution chain. The DNS firewall allows you to control and monitor the domains that your application can query. And so in this example, they gave us, if you're going to say alexa.com, amazon.com, you'll soon find out that's a CNAME for pitnjui.amazon.com, which is a CNAME to tp.5fd53c724-frontier.amazon.com, which is also a CNAME to d1wg1w6p5q855.cloudfront.net, with only the CloudFront address actually resolving to an IP address of 3.162.42.28. Do not try to copy this at home because your answer will be different because that's how CloudFront works. So that could be a problem in this model where you're trying to now authorize only valid DNS resolutions. As a firewall admin, you might have been tempted to just put in a star.amazon.com, but that would have failed because it's, of course, CloudFront at the end of the day. Or you would have star.cloudfront.net, which would also be bad because that could be a lot of bad internet websites. Worse, the DNS CNAME is controlled by a service that and chain that might change at any time, forcing you to manually maintain the list of rules and authorized domains. So with this new parameter added to the update firewall rule API and AWS managed console to configure the DNS firewalls that it follows and automatically trusts all the domains in a CNAME or DNAME chain. This makes it simpler by just entering your application query domain, and you can turn this on for a specific rule or for so you don't turn it on for everything. You do it for just the ones that have a CNAME that you know of. So you're not deep protecting yourself or putting a hole in your firewall.
I love when we cause a problem and we're like, here's a whole new blog post about how we've solved it.
Yeah. Seems like this should have been thought of before they went live with this feature, perhaps.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Did they go live and then like, someone freaked out and, you know, they got a bunch of negative feedback and then they were like, whoa. We quickly rolled out this feature, or did they like already have it in testing and they just missed the cutoff for production release?
It's kind of crazy because, I can't imagine this not coming up during a beta test or early adopter test. Like, this is a very common, you know, Amazon workload is going to, see, you'd think they'd hit this day one.
You would have thought
crazy.
I mean, you also would have figured that they, you know, Amazon's best practice is to CNAME everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, why would you not just have this?
I mean, I'm glad they have it now.
Yeah. I'm just glad I didn't find this sharp edge on my own.
Right?
Yeah. So. I find enough of them in life.
Yeah, I guess it was like an implementation choice. You know, if we could only whitelist the first name was looked up, then I guess they had no control over upstream resolution necessarily. But I guess they fixed their resolver now to allow that kind of customization. This is actually really cool for not just for for this use case, though. Think about SaaS companies who host on Amazon. Yeah. And I've seen many of them. They're like, you know, you need to whitelist star.s3.amazonaws.com. Mm-hmm. And that's a security company, literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
no.
So by using dnames, they could actually move all that namespace that they use for the public Amazon services into their own, you know, example.com domain. And then you could whitelist that. And then this would allow sort of safety in using SaaS services. That's kind of cool. Lots of use cases.
Well, I'm going to ask a dumb question. What's a dname? I've never really dealt with those.
Dnames, it's a way of like mapping subdomains into parts of other domains. So you could map, let me think of an example.
I was trying to quickly look it up.
Oh. Okay. Dname record provides redirection from a part of the DNS name tree to another part of the DNS name tree. The example they give is the host www.domain.net could have a dname to hostname.com.
Yeah, you can map multiple subdomains into a different namespace effectively.
Interesting. All right. Well, that'll be something to quiz the new... an SRE hire on soon. Have you heard of a dname? Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, they've only been around for 12 years, I think so. You know.
Is it really been around?
I think so. I think the RFC is that old.
I mean, I was sure Ryan would know what it was because it's probably some old RFC spec. And so I assume he was going to be the one to educate us all. But no, we had to go to the internet. So.
I've never heard of it. Shocked.
Ooh, what's the date on it? Dname resolution? July 26th, 2011. So it's only, not that old. 13 years.
Well, there's a couple of quality of life improvements other than dnames, which we've now learned here on the cloud. A couple of AMI updates. So first of all, they gave us the ability to now find out when your AMI was last used to launch an EC2 instance by describing your AMI, enabling you to efficiently filter and track your active AMIs. All I can say is thank you.
Oh, sweet Jesus. Yeah.
It's awesome.
And then the second one is you can also now prevent AMI from accident deregistration by marking them as protected. A protected AMI cannot be deregistered until you explicitly disable the deregistration protection. Also, thank you having accidentally clicked that button before.
Yeah, definitely like taking down production because you accidentally deregister the wrong AMI. Definitely haven't done that one in life.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that they, you know, like they didn't link the two features together where it's like you have visibility of it being used and you wouldn't delete it if it's in use.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be too logical.
Mm-hmm. Just say you have the Amazon, which is how many individual blog posts and features can we put out, and the Azure one that says how many can we put into one blog post.
Mm-hmm. But he's really talking about the fact that yes, they did do two blog posts, which Azure would not have. His point is more of if you know it was used in the last 90 days, don't allow it to be deleted. Or if there's currently a running instance using that AMI, don't let it be deleted. But I think it's
pop up and tell you.
Yeah,
something. Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm going to channel my Amazon, you know, product team rep and be like, well, you can just write a Lambda for that.
You're right. Mm-hmm. Lambda can solve all of life's problems, or you can solve the toil for me.
Well, for those of you who like to burn money with things like MongoDB Atlas, you can now combine it with the knowledge base for Amazon Bedrock to combine all of your RAG solutions together to burn all the money together. So with this integration, you can build RAG solutions to securely connect your organization's private data sources to KB for Amazon Bedrock. This integration adds a list of vector stores supported by KB for Bedrock, including Aurora Postgres Compatible Edition, Vector Engine for OpenSearch Serverless, Pinecone, Redis Enterprise Cloud, and now MongoDB Atlas.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. I had a chat with a Mongo sales guy not that long ago about this, actually. It's pretty cool. I don't, you know, it's definitely an us too feature. I don't think, you know, it's if you want a vector engine, I don't think MongoDB will be your first choice if you weren't already using it. But it's a great additional feature if you've already got it in the stack.
In a feature that I assumed already existed, you can now see file commit history in Amazon Code Catalyst. Customers now view the file, get commit history. This helps you plan, code, build, test, and deploy applications on AWS. I mean, it makes you wonder, how did it ever pull a Git repo before if you didn't know what the pass was to know there was a change? So I appreciate that you now give me the visibility into that thing that you already probably had all along.
It's funny because I've used this for a lot of personal projects. And I'm like, I'd never noticed this. And I was researching, oh, that's because I linked all my Code Catalyst environments to GitHub.
Key step.
Right.
Got it.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
You mean you don't put all your code into CodeKit?
I did not, no.
Yeah, every time I try to use code commit, I get angry, rage angry, and I just go back to GitHub.
So. Yeah, I get that feeling.
Code pipeline V2 type pipelines now support stage level rollback to help customers to confidently deploy changes to their production environment. When a pipeline execution fails in a stage due to any action, customers can quickly get that stage to a known good state by rolling back to a previously successful pipeline execution in that stage. Now, if only it was really that easy of just rolling back a stage, like no big deal, like, ooh, yeah, I've rolled back. That assumes, of course, a lot of assumptions about your application. If it's a static web application, yes, 100% accurate. If this is a DB deployment, 100% inaccurate, and do not do this without understanding the risk to your business.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as, you know, and it is supported, it's, you know, it's configurable at the stage level, then you're fine. But yeah, this is one of those things where I was like, this is cool. And you think through actually, you know, using it, like, yeah, but this is probably not going to work in a lot of cases. But it's still, you know, it's nice for, you know, even if you're, you know, for there's code pipeline and there's also just, you know, deploying tests and different integration tests, you know, and having that be something that you can retry or reset to a good working state and move on to different parts of the pipeline is pretty cool.
Yeah. If I confidently deploy changes, it's going to be because I've tested in many environments and not because the tool says it can roll back for me magically.
How to know that Jonathan's not a day-to-day application developer? Something that no application developer has ever said.
Tell me you're a DevOps engineer without telling me you're a DevOps engineer. all right. Well, there was a fun Twitter back and forth and Medium post last week as well. This Medium post basically written by Masiej Pasuera. It said, you know, imagine a scenario of creating an empty private AWS S3 bucket. And what should that bucket then cost you a day later? And he tells you that if you screw this up, it can cost you a lot of money. So he basically created a new bucket. He created the S3 bucket and uploaded some files for testing of a new document indexing system he was working on. And 2 days later, he checked his AWS billing page to make sure he was in the free tier to find out he wasn't. And it was costing him over $1,300 with the billing console showing nearly 100 million S3 put requests executed in a single day. He didn't know where this was coming from, and he had enabled S3 logging or CloudTrail. So he enabled the CloudTrail logs to see thousands of write requests originating from multiple accounts or entirely outside of AWS. Kind of find out there is an open source tool that have a default configuration to store their backups in S3. And as a placeholder for a bucket name, they use the same name that he happened to have chosen. Fools. So a ton of systems are attempting to store data. And worse, S3 is charging him for every unauthorized incoming request, a 403, to be specific. Worse, if you don't specify a bucket region, AWS will redirect your bucket request from US East 1 to the actual bucket and get you to pay for that additional charge as well.
Oof.
He went further and decided to let the bucket accept public writes for 30 seconds, and he received 10 gigs of backup data in 30 seconds. He updated the open source tool maintainers, and they fixed their default configuration. He also notified the AWS security team, and he reported the customer's data he found in the bucket to the customers, where he said they did ignore his email, assuming it's probably spam. AWS also refunded him the $1,300. This was being chatted around quite a bit about how this is a great exploit and a way to really hurt your enemies. And Jeff Barr jumped in to the fray and said that they're acknowledging the issue publicly, and his voice at the AWS agrees customers should not have to pay for unauthorized requests that they did not initiate and are going to fix it. And then today he posted an update that they're working very hard to get this fixed very quickly. And they'll cover a range of HTTP 300 and 400 SAS codes, including all the ones mentioned in the article. And they hope to share more details within the next week or so. So we'll talk about that when that gets announced as a feature. That's a fun little exploit that could definitely have burned you if you weren't aware of it. But make sure your bucket name doesn't match a common example bucket name for a project.
Or if you're an evil person, you make it that and collect everyone's data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but S3 bucket names are very easy to find, though, because as soon as you attach a SSL certificate to it, it becomes public knowledge in the registry of issued certificates. And so, I mean, there's open source apps you can use that just give you a list of most recently issued SSL certs. And so it's easy to find thousands of buckets. I don't think you know, if the guy's running a static site, it's probably got a cert. It's probably easy to find.
Yeah. I was more impressed with Amazon's reaction to this in terms of like, you know, like they haven't fixed it. Apparently this is not a new issue. It's been reported before, but just the amount of attention this got and how quickly there was a response. And then now, you know, a follow-up within, you know, next coming week sort of ETA, which is, I thought was pretty impressive given the timescale that we're talking about too.
Yeah. I'm interested to see how they're going to fix it and if anyone's going to actually try and exploit the fix. I know I made a joke post on Twitter about exploiting the fix. But, you know.
I mean, whole like idea that they're going to be able to know if it's an unauthorized request coming from someone other than you. I'm like, what? Because it didn't come from my Amazon account? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, but think about it. Like if you use S3 to hold a flag, you know, when you set the flag, you want something to happen. You could have thousands of apps all over the world checking to see if an object exists in S3, mm-hmm. and you're getting 403, 403, 403, hundreds of millions of times a day. And then when you put that object there because you want, you know, your botnet to do whatever, then all of a sudden, great. You know, they all get the message and it didn't cost you anything for all the days that it was returning the not found error, mm-hmm. or the forbidden error, at least.
I'm not evil enough, is what I've just learned. I don't know that I would have ever thought about that with Jonathan. I'm not evil enough.
Well, I only think about these things. Only is not true. I was going to say, I only think about these things because I build stuff and I don't want people to exploit my things.
But, yeah. That's why he thinks about
it. Totally. Yeah. That's totally the reason.
Yep.
He's not trying to mine Bitcoin on everyone else's S3 bucket. No, not at all.
Yeah.
I more just hope that like, whatever that default is, like Amazon has now taken that bucket over. And so that like random people's backups are now just visible to the world or whoever has, if he's retained it or whatever. So, because 10 gigabytes in 30 seconds, that's really fast. And that's a lot of data to whatever this open source project was. I don't remember.
They didn't say.
It's a security risk. He mentioned, you know, they updated the repo for people who've already downloaded the project. They had an update to get it, and so who knows how long that'll take. definitely a good change.
Do you know what's more old school than blowing on a Nintendo cartridge to make it work? Manually creating individual policies to achieve least privilege in your cloud. Leave old habits in the past, and with a single click, lock down access to sensitive permissions and services without disrupting DevOps. With the new Cloud Permissions Firewall from Sunry Security, you can easily restrict excessive permissions from human and machine identities, quarantine unused identities, and restrict specific regions and unused services with a click of a button. Start a 14-day free trial for Sunry's Cloud Permissions Firewall at sunry.co/cloudpod. That's sonrai.co/cloudpod.
All right, moving on to GCP. And first up is ConfigSync, Google Cloud's fully managed GitOps offering for GKE, lets cluster operators and platform administrators deploy configurations and applications from a source of truth, which is always good to do on GitHub. Today, they're announcing a new auto upgrade feature in preview, letting you automatically upgrade ConfigSync versions and oversee the lifecycle of ConfigSync components. Auto upgrade is an opt-in feature available for new and existing ConfigSync installations, and the benefits of this are low maintenance overhead, maintained support, and enforced reliability. Auto upgrades that match the GKE release channels of rapid, regular, and stable are all supported by GKE ConfigSync. Which, this is a good way to cause an outage, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still go back to like, I wish Kubernetes was simple enough where this wasn't as big of a deal. Like it should be able to auto upgrade between versions and it shouldn't break everything, but it does. It breaks everything. I've seen it. I don't understand why it breaks everything when you update Kubernetes. It's frustrating.
Don't like auto updates in production. It just terrifies me.
I do. I don't. I'm not going to upgrade it otherwise.
I like you in dev and then you just, you know, take that and promote it up whenever you're ready and break the lower environment.
I mean, the problem is there's so much complexity in Kubernetes and so much deprecation of old legacy APIs right now that I just don't feel like the API is that stable. So breaking changes is just the nature of the beast.
Yeah, and I do like to, you know, promote changes through, like SLDC, but not everything is being actively developed on it. So like, what do? It's kind of chaos.
Chaos is the best kind. So
yeah. I guess if you have Kubernetes, you have a platform team. You know, I think is the answer. Yes.
Platform team is the way forward.
Yeah.
Well, there's another Magic Quadrant out. This one is for Cloud AI Developer Services, which I had to figure out what that meant. So this is basically Cloud AI Developer Services are cloud hosted or containerized services and products that enable software developers who are not data science experts to use AI models via APIs, SDKs, or applications. They have several definitions of features they must have, including a tabular service, a language service, and a vision service. As well as standard features, including automated data prep, automated feature engineering and model building, model management operationalization, responsible AI, natural language understanding, speech to text, text to speech, natural language generation, translation, image recognition, video AI, ML enabled OCR, image video generation, AI code assistance. And so there are four companies that are in the leader Magic Quadrant, with Amazon being the highest to execute, but not as complete of a vision. Microsoft having a complete vision but poor ability to execute, and Google sitting below AWS and Microsoft, and to the left of Microsoft and to the right of Amazon, because this is an audio podcast. I have no way to describe that to you, but they're a cluster with that breakdown. The fourth one is IBM, barely holding on to the leader quadrant at the very edge. And so looking at the three cloud providers we care about, the strengths and weaknesses all look a little familiar to me. So AWS strengths: geographic strategy, vertical industry strategy, and the overall viability of their solutions, with cautions being marketing execution, which why marketing matters, I don't know. Market understanding and innovation. Google has the product, the market responsiveness, and the overall viability, with cautions being customer experience, vertical industry strategy, and marketing execution. And Microsoft being product, geographic strategy, and overall viability, with cautions of market understanding, market execution, and innovation. So overall, they're all the same things. So there's not much difference between them. And I think you're probably okay with all of them.
You know, I wonder why Amazon lacked completeness of vision, honestly. I guess it depends. I mean, from what perspective are they reporting on this? Because, you know, in my mind, I think what Amazon has done is very smart. They have all the tools to use any model you want. And they didn't pay a cent in building their own models. You know, Meta paid for Llama, Anthropics paid for Claude. There's a whole bunch of models you can use on Amazon. Plus, I mean, they do have the vision services, they do have the natural language services and things like that. But, you know, they didn't pay any money, haven't invested anything in building their own customer-facing models apart from Q, but we won't talk about Q. So, I mean, is not providing a service lack of completeness of vision, or is that just a business choice that made sense?
I think it was just a business choice that made sense, but
yeah.
Now they're trying to mess with the definition of these things. You know, the other thing that's kind of interesting to me is, you know, OpenAI is like way over to the right on completeness of vision, but has a very low ability to execute. And I'm sort of like, well, but they're executing with Microsoft, who you just put in the top. So I don't really get it. yeah, it's just sort of weird. Like this feels like the phone it in. Magic Quadrant, where they were like, we don't really know how to differentiate them right now, and so we've thrown everything in the kitchen sink in, and they're all doing it, and so they're all sort of equal.
Yeah. This feels to me like Gartner just invented a category that didn't need a category. Like, this is, you know, what isn't there a separate AI or generative AI?
Yes.
Magic Quadrant, and so it's like they're, I don't know if there's enough of a delta between the two.
Which I think is why you're saying this quadrant isn't really that far
doesn't
spread
really,
out.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't quite make sense, your definition.
But so why are they announcing Google's the leader when Google is neither
all the way to the top or all the way to the right?
Yeah, right. It's neither top in any category. Nor if you look at the distance from the kind of the origin of the graph, is it furthest away from the origin? So, you know, I don't know.
Oh, I mean, the reason why it says Google is the leader is because it's a Google press release.
You say a leader. I'm sorry, a leader, not the leader. Okay, well, we're all leaders, aren't we?
They're all in the top leaders section.
They're all leaders in the box, man. Like,
yeah,
like, whatever
leaders box.
Yeah, I mean, so you're getting into like the actual report. Yeah, so they do note here some of Google's recent advance, which is release of Gemini 1.5 models and its open source Gemini models, occurred after our research cutoff date and were not included in the scoring for the quadrant. So, yeah. this is Gemini 1.0. They said, you know, products, Google Vertex AI stands out for its extensive language support offered through a portfolio of pre-built APIs and capabilities of summarization, classification, and generation of natural language. Market responsiveness, they say, you know, they're moving quickly with the model garden and the RAG, and their viability is they're backed by Google. So yeah, they have big pockets. But cautions, you know, they dinged them on customer experience. You know, the support is typically via Google Groups and Slack channels. Multiple support tiers and 24/7, and its services support score on Gartner's peer insights platform is below other vendors in the quadrant. Also, Google's product portfolio is vast and comprehensive and complex. You know, vertical specific solutions to provide a portfolio of models, data platforms, and AI applications and APIs designed for specific industry use cases. Yeah, I buy that one. And then, but they do have SecLM and MetLM, so they have a little bit. And then marketing execution, you know, they've consistently delivered its CADE strategy and portfolio for the enterprise buyer. But they've ignored other consumer-oriented innovations, but they're maturing. So I don't know. It sort of feels, again, I just don't see it. Like, these aren't the reasons why I think any of these companies have strengths or weaknesses in this particular magic quadrant. So this one, I think this magic quadrant is a swing and a miss for me. Mm-hmm. I think it's off the quadrant.
We can rename the show, Google Takes the Participation Trophy.
Yeah, exactly.
Gartner's Magic Quadrant.
I think everyone's head just gets a participation trophy right now until the area kind of defines itself more.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I wish they'd do for these magic quadrants? It says this has been around for 4 years now, 5 years. This is the fifth year. So it'd be nice if they actually made an animation to show how businesses were moving through the quadrant or relative to each other. It'd be kind of cool to see the stuff like that.
It's the most innovative thing Gartner's ever would have done in the last 20 years. Like, you should send that in. They might give you a finder's fee.
Can I charge them $100,000 for it?
Sure. I have a great idea for you. 100 grand. Done. you make that, work that out. All right. Well, proving their leadership in the space, Google is launching a PyTorch dataset abstraction, the Dataflux dataset, for accelerating data loaded from Google Cloud Storage. Dataflux provides up to 3.5 faster training compared to its FSS spec with small files. See? Magic Quadrant, screw you. So BigQuery has a new capability for managed disaster recovery. So out of the box, you get BigQuery with an industry-leading 99.99% uptime SLA for availability within a single geographic region. The full redundancy across two data centers within a single region is included with every BigQuery dataset you create and it's managed transparently. But no, that's not enough for some of you out there. And so if you need enhanced redundancy across large geographic regions, they are now introducing Managed Disaster Recovery for BigQuery. And this feature, now in preview, offers automated failure of compute and storage and a new cross-region SLA tailored for business-critical workloads. This feature enables you to ensure business continuity in the unlikely event of a total regional infrastructure outage. Managed DR also provides failover configurations for capacity reservation so you can manage query and storage failover behavior. And this is all part of the BigQuery Enterprise Plus edition.
It's weird when you think about a managed service like this and resiliency, because it's sort of like that. This is if the BigQuery endpoint is having issues in that region, right? Like it's very weird to think about in that sense, but you know, it does happen. And so if you've got a business critical workload that's making queries dynamically.
I like the ability to give Google more money with capacity reservations in your DL region. So that when the first region fails and everyone goes and launches in the DR region, you still have your reservation capacity.
I've been dealing with a bank at the day job who's requiring us to buy those. I was like, this is such a scam. Like, I get why you care. I get why you want the guarantee that in the event that a region dies, that we have the capacity. I get all your reasons for it, but it still feels scammy.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to know, what I want is the cloud providers to provide transparency of what's the spot market percentage in a given data center? Because if the spot market is, you know, equivalents of 30 or 40% of the workload in that region, those people are all dead in DR. So we're taking their capacity and I don't think I'm too worried about it. But, you know, there's some transparency that the cloud providers can provide. But instead, they'll just sell you this guaranteed capacity at an upcharge. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think especially in smaller geographies where maybe there's one region or maybe there's two regions and you don't have much choice to go elsewhere for data residency requirements, I think it'd be really useful to know exactly, if this data center went down, what's the chances of us having some free capacity in your other data center in our region. And based on many phone calls and meetings around capacity planning, I would say slim to none.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I mean, the reality in most situations is that if, if you, took out LA, for example, with a bomb, and, all those companies that are, not fully based in LA, who care, are now DRing. Like, the number of companies DRing to other data centers and other cloud regions in that period of time is going to surpass all of the spare capacity of all cloud providers in that region. Mm-hmm. I almost guarantee it.
Yeah. So. Well, even with Azure, they have the paired region concept. So it's like, you already know everything's going to fail over. So everyone in this region is going to move to this one. And in some places, your failover, you have to request access to. Then you really know that they're not going to have enough capacity there to run it. So, yes, I get the concept of capacity blocks, but at that point, some minor service is probably not going to run, that you're going to have a bigger problem.
All right, well, let's move on to RSA week. So RSA is happening in San Francisco Bay this week as we record. There might be other announcements we'll talk about next week, but Google has dropped two announcements on Sunday, starting out the conference with a bang. First up, they announced Google Threat Intelligence, a new offering that combines the unmatched depth of their Mandiant frontline expertise, the global reach of the virus total community, and the breadth of visibility only Google can deliver based on billions of signals across devices and emails. Google Threat Intelligence includes Gemini in Threat Intelligence, the AI-powered agent that provides a conversational search across the vast repository of threat intelligence, enabling customers to gain insights and protect them from threats faster than before. The key features are Google Threat Insights, which we just talked about, the frontline intelligence of the elite incident responders and security consultants, human-curated threat intelligence from Mandiant, crowdsourced threat intelligence from VirusTotal, and open-source threat intelligence using the open-source threat intelligence community. And the second announcement in this space is the Google Security Operations is getting additional AI capabilities, and the update is designed to reduce the do-it-yourself complexity of SecOps and enhance the productivity of the entire Security Operations Center team. To help reduce manual processes and provide better security outcomes, the two improvements are cloud detections that can address serverless threats, crypto mining incidents across Google Cloud, all Google Cloud and Security Command Center enterprise findings, anomalous user behavior rules, machine learning generated lists of prioritized endpoint alerts, and baseline coverage for AWS, including identity, compute, data services, and secret management. They've also added detections based on learnings from the Mandiant managed defense team, as well as frontline threat detections can provide coverage for recently detected methodologies and is based on threat actor tactics, techniques, and procedures. So AI for SOC and security. Nice.
Intel's going to be so upset with you. You didn't say Intel driven.
Sorry.
They probably paid a fortune to have that been in the name and you glossed right over it.
Intel driven AI powered SecOps. Sorry. You can send my check in the mail. Mm-hmm. I think anything we can help security people with is a win. I don't know all the threat intelligence. It sounds like threat noise in a lot of ways. Cause when you win with too many signals, it's just all noise at some point. And yes, it could be valid, your dark web monitoring, Ryan. It also could just be noise because I'm I don't know who data got hacked to get my email address this time. It's only the 15th this week, so who knows? But it's nice to see something.
So I got to play around with a demo of this at Google Next. It's cool because it where everything, from a SecOps perspective was very specific queries, and trying to do that for stuff that's not forensics, is very difficult, right? And so this provides sort of the ability to write filters and rules in natural language, and it'll sort of adapt based off of what it's seeing through your environment. So it's not like writing a very complex query of mapping in all these different, keywords and string them together. It's now much easier to sort of check these, describe a pattern of usage that looks bad, and then it'll sort of, it's like a fuzzy search. Great. I like it.
All right, Matt, we're moving on to Azure, and you're going to be up first.
Oh, no.
So beginning last week, Azure started enabling the root manage group for tenants that have not been enabled yet. Azure manager groups leverage best practices when applying Azure policy and have it pre-enabled, reducing the initial setup work to follow the best practices. This is being done to provide a governance scope above subscriptions to manage policies and compliance for those subscriptions efficiently. And to Matt, I say, huh? I don't get it.
Don't worry, I had to look it up too. At my day job, we already have it enabled. So it's one of those things I just never thought about. But essentially, in the past, when you have your organization structure, there was no top level. So if you wanted to apply a policy to everything, you had to apply it to all the subfolders. This was one of those things that over time was just, hey, best practices, you just set this up. And now this is just Microsoft saying, here you go, we're setting it up for you.
Which they could have done forever ago. So it just only took them years to do it. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So I mean, like, this is for customers who only have like one project and don't really care, didn't know this was a problem they didn't have. Oh, I got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things, if you've got a bunch of projects or subscriptions that are managed in different folders, different hierarchies, right? And you want to make a change to everything, you would have to go make a change to every single subscription or every single folder closure defined in.
Yeah, you can have sub-management groups too. So you can have like your primary, like your production, and then you could have like my GDPR and non-GDPR, you know, management groups. And then, so this way you could just say all managing groups at the top level, kind of filter it down that way. So it's one of those, probably should have been there a while ago, slash they had it, they just didn't enable it by default. And now they're retroactively going in and just doing something.
So do you think they're retroactively turning it on because they're going to announce something else, like build that requires it? And so they're like, well, we just need to turn it on then. Or do you think it's just they finally caught up to their tech debt backlog? Like, what? It's so weird.
I think it's a little bit of like tech debt security, you know, that they are, as we'll talk about later, but security is a big focus. I think this is one of those, hey, look, we're focusing on security. Here's an easy win type of thing to say that we've done.
All right. Well, user-defined route management in Azure Virtual Network Manager is now in public preview. This feature enables you to describe your desired routing behavior in Azure Virtual Network Manager by defining and applying routing rules to multiple subnets and virtual networks without manually configuring the route tables for each subnet. And I'm really just disappointed this didn't come out with a conversational AI interface to it, so I could just tell it, I want to connect from that thing to that thing. It just does it.
Don't worry, there'll be a co-pilot for Virtual Firewall Manager soon that they'll charge you a low amount of $5 per month per user that has to interact with it.
I mean, if they could just add a chatbot to the console, Azure console, I might actually be able to use the console. Well, that might just be another version of Q, so maybe that's not so great.
I'm trying to understand something without having to manually configure the tables for each subnet. So you still have to provide all the configuration information, but just not configuring the tables
for each subnet. Okay. It's like I'm setting up an alias that has these routes that I'm going to use attached to all these different subnets. And instead of doing it for every subnet, I'm just going to apply the alias to it. And now I get it.
Yeah, okay. So it's like policy-based routing, basically, where you make groups of IP sets.
But they've used funny words, Jonathan.
Yeah. I mean, why use standard terminology when you can make a blog post out of it?
Yeah, exactly. 3,000 words. It's perfect. Microsoft is excited to introduce Phi-3, a family of OpenAI models developed by Microsoft. Phi-3 models are the most capable and cost-effective small language models, or SLMs, available, outperforming models of the same size and the next size up across a variety of language, reasoning, coding, and math benchmarks. This release expands the selection of high-quality models for customers, offering more practical choices as they compose and build generative AI applications. The first one is the Phi-3 Mini, a 3.8 billion language model, is available on Microsoft Azure AI Studio, Hugging Face, and Llama. Phi-3 Mini is available in two context length variants, the 4K and the 128K token variant, and two additional models, the Phi-3 Small 7B and Phi-3 Medium 14B will be available in the next few weeks on the Studio as well.
Cool. We should come up with some kind of benchmarking, you know, amusing comedic benchmarking questions for these language models for the podcast. So when people announce things like this, we can have previously asked it a question and then report on the answer.
So, you know, they have the technical paper in the article where they basically have a chart and has all these numbers. And I don't know what any of the numbers mean. So like I could compare them. Like the Phi-3 Mini 4K on the AGI evaluation scores a 37.5 versus Gemma 7B only scored a 42.1. Is higher number or lower number better? I have no idea. I don't know what any of these numbers even mean. So that's why I don't talk about them on the show, because I'm like, I have no idea what these numbers even hell. Like, what am I comparing apples to apples or apples to oranges? I have no idea.
Well, the other problem is as soon as you start training models to beat the benchmarks, they cheat, you know, and it doesn't become meaningful anymore. I think asking a, you know, you see questions, funny questions online, like, you know, apart from Europe, which other continents begin with an A? Like, obviously, Europe doesn't begin with an A, but it many models just gloss over that, ignore the error in the question, and excuse me, and answer the question as best they can. And so I think things like that are the real tests to catch these models out. Also some funny stuff.
So it's you're basically trained to be an idiot like the rest of us. Perfect. This is how we die. This is how Skynet starts.
Sorry, started. We just haven't realized it yet.
Like, I would ask that question. But Europe doesn't start with an A?
Yeah. Which is heavier, a pound of lead or a pound of feathers? You know, like trick questions like that. We need a cloud pub benchmark. I'll make one.
Then all the models get trained for it. So I look forward to that. All right. So we talked about it a few weeks ago, the shellacking that Microsoft took from the government on their response to the state actor who hacked Exchange. Basically, it was such a big deal that Satya Nadella actually spent a bunch of time at the earnings last week, which we didn't talk about when we talked about earnings, actually addressing security and why security is going to be a big focus for the company now going forward. And so that has now resulted in a blog post, which is more interesting to talk about than their financials. First of all, Satya's note starts out with an edict, prioritizing security above all else. He goes on to say, Microsoft runs on trust and their success depends on earning and maintaining it. They have a unique opportunity and responsibility to build the most secure and trusted platform that the world innovates upon. Satya says they launched their Secure Future Initiative, or SFI, with this responsibility in mind, bringing together every part of the company to advance cybersecurity protection across both new products and legacy infrastructure. This started in November. Going forward, they will commit the entirety of the organization to SFI as they double down on the initiative with an approach grounded in three core principles. Secure by design, security comes first when designing any product or service. Secure by default, security protections are enabled and enforced by default, requiring no extra effort and are not optional. Secure operations, security controls, and monitoring will continuously be improved to meet current and future threats. And these three principles will govern every facet of their SFI pillars. Protect identities and secrets, protect tenants and isolate production systems, protect networks, protect engineering systems, monitor and detect threats, and accelerate responses and remediation. In addition, they will install accountability by basing part of the compensation of the senior leadership team on their progress towards meeting their security plans and milestones. And they must approach this challenge with both technical and operational rigor, with a focus on continuous improvement. Security is a team sport, and accelerating SFI isn't the job number one of our security team. It's everyone's top priority and our customers' greatest need. If you're with a trade-off between security and another priority, your answer is clear: do security. In some cases, this will mean prioritize security above other things we do, such as releasing new features or providing ongoing support for legacy systems. So, a lot of words here. Very excited to see them say this. But is this enough to change the culture? Is this Satya's internet is the future, you know, memo to Microsoft that changed the entire company one direction? Is this the moment Microsoft gets super secure, or is this a lot of smoke and no fire?
No, and until they see security as a feature, I think we're still going to have a problem. It's like, no new features. We're going to focus on security. I'm like, it is a feature. It's an important feature. You shouldn't consider it not a feature. This is why we end up in the situation.
The problem is product teams don't always consider that. Product managers don't always consider a feature. They need the next shiny thing out there, you know. So where do they, you end up sitting, and does the product team, and does then Microsoft get dinged on their next, you know, quarterly earning of, hey, last time you released 50 features and this time you released 40 features. What happened? Oh, well, we were fixing all of our security holes. Well, it's not really a good story either.
Yeah, we missed our growth numbers because we were busy patching vulnerabilities. Sorry.
On the other hand, you know, having Office 365 hacked by a nation state and losing critical government documents, that might be considered harmful too.
I mean, if you don't fix that problem, you end up start losing government agencies. That's a big loss too. That'll affect the other line on the balance sheet. But I guess that makes sense now about that updating management groups now. They didn't have anything else to do, so they just said, well, let's do the secure thing. But make it a default and turn it on.
Yeah. They've done their 20% security backlog tech debt work for the sprint by releasing that press release.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely hope that this gets fixed. I mean, we use Office 365, the day job. I mean, it's part of every corporation I've ever been at, I think, has been Office 365 customer, at least some form of it. And, you know, like, I already know my data is getting hacked on the dark web anyways. It'd be nice if it's not because of Microsoft being stupid. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. I kind of wish that the SFI pillars that he mentioned were not something that, you know, we've harped on this podcast for years.
Yeah. So, yeah. Sorry. Oh, you came up with that your own? Secure by design, secure by default, and secure operations, and you put a fancy acronym on top of it? Thanks. Appreciate that. Yeah. You know, nothing we haven't talked about for years. I mean, like, but like, where's Charlie Bell been in all this? Like, sleep at the helm? Like, what's going on?
Viciously quiet. Yeah.
I mean, maybe he's not a public eye kind of guy, but it seems strange that he hasn't been touted a little bit on this stuff. Microsoft Azure is now available in Mexico. Viva la Mexico. The first cloud region of Mexico is now available with Azure Availability Zones and provides organizations across the globe with access to scalable, highly available, and resilient Microsoft Cloud services while confirming its commitment to promoting digital transformation and sustainable innovation in the country of Mexico.
Always good to see your workloads. Go global. Excellent.
I just quickly looked. AWS is doing it shortly too. So I feel like you're going to see a lot more. You know, you're seeing a lot more of these small localized zones in countries, I feel like, just due to all the data residency requirements that every country is slowly producing.
Yep. Well, I have an Oracle story for you guys this week. Since the launch of the best database ever known to man called Oracle Database 23C, they've been working for the last 4 years to develop the next generation of Oracle Database. And they're proud to announce to you today Oracle Database 23 AI.
Nice.
The game-changing innovations of Database 23 AI have included focus on three key areas: AI for data, dev for data, and mission critical for data. Yes, indeed. Cool.
What does that mean?
So their goal with AI for data was to enable app developers to add AI functionality into their data-driven applications more easily and to incorporate Gen AI capabilities into our products so that all the users of Oracle Database, from data analysis to app developers database, can be more productive. Yeah,
that sounds to me AI for data, AI for developers, and AI for more money.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They didn't mention even more pricing increases in the 23 AI, but you know, lots of things about, you know, augmenting LLMs, there's secure encoding of data, you can ask questions naturally, you can find new insights available in all editions of Oracle Database. So, you know, not even making it something that you can only get in the Enterprise Edition, which is shocking to me. And then for dev for data is actually interesting because if you're having the difficult choice of JSON or relational, which apparently is a difficult choice per Oracle, they support both options now directly natively in the relational tables. So you can store your JSON in duality views if that's something you're into. And if you understood anything I just said there, you're super excited. But JSON and databases seems terrible to me, as well as there's new graph support in SQL Oracle. And then mission critical data is sharding. Sharding faster, better, and simpler, which no sharding is ever fast, simple, or quick. As well as they now have a new caching layer to truly offload reads from the database tier to application servers. And they've also made SQL execution safer with the SQL allow lists and SQL deny lists. And then there's apparently 300 other features they didn't care about because they didn't mention AI in any way. And so they skipped those. So there you go. Oracle 23 AI.
I've totally missed on that. I wish I read the Oracle story before we figured out what the show title was going to be. It could have been Oracle Database 23 AI shards itself. The numbering is so funny, though. It's like the kind of customers, the kind of enterprise customers Oracle have are going to be the customers that take like 10 years to upgrade an Oracle version because of all the testing and everything they want to do. So it's like, we need new features and we want to push updates out, but it's also still mostly the same. So we're going to keep the 23. And instead of going from C to D, we're going to go to AI.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. New stuff, but it's the same.
Well, so back when I was pretending I was going to be an Oracle DBA versus a network engineer and I basically went to networking, the Oracle latest days at the time was Oracle 8 and the new version was Oracle 8i, which stood for internet. So that was,
oh, wow.
They have a trend of this before. This is not something they do not done in the past. Matthew also had a mid-show title, which was You're a D-Name. which was also pretty good too. Mm-hmm. So you guys need to think about these show titles before we record, so we can come up with them.
Do our homework.
You sure? That's funny. If anyone ever says TNS names to me, that's a trigger.
Oh, word. Yeah. TNS listener. Oh. Anyways. All right, guys. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. See what's coming up with the rest of RSA and all the other things in the cloud.
See you later.
Bye, everybody.
And that's the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank this week's sponsor, Sunry. Check out a 14-day free trial at sunry.co/cloudpod. Check out our website, the home of the CloudPod, where you can check out our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet at us with hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod.